Another secret tape reveals Republican Senator Mitch McConnell mocking would-be political rival Ashley Judd. Mother Jones Magazine's Washington Bureau Chief David Korn was responsible for tracking down and publishing both stories. He's just received the prestigious Polk Award for political reporting. David Korn joins me in the studio. You're invited to be part of the conversation. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Diane.
Good to have you here. And David, once again, congratulations on the Polk Award.
Thank you very much. It was actually an honor to be part of all the people who got awards last week, including two great reporters, Austin Tice and David Enders, who covered the war in Syria. And Austin has been missing since August. They think that the Syrian government has him, and there are some behind-the-scenes
efforts
being made.
Yeah.
And, guys like that are really the gutsy people in our profession, and I'm just really hoping that he comes home soon.
As do all of us. You know, certainly since you obtained that recording, that videotape of the Mitt Romney statement about 47%, you've sort of been in the headlights here. And then you obtained an audio recording of Senator Mitch McConnell. Before we play two little portions of that tape, tell us what's on them, because the first one is a little difficult to understand.
Well, if the first clip is the one from Mitch McConnell himself, I'll give you the background. This was a meeting held February 2nd. It was the day that Mitch McConnell opened his reelection campaign headquarters in Louisville, Kentucky. And after this unveiling, a couple dozen supporters were there. He spoke. He had a private strategy session with aides, and it was and the part of the tape, part of the meeting that the tape captured was when they were going over what we call oppo research, opposition research, research into potential challengers to Mitch McConnell. Foremost among them at that time was the actor, activist Ashley Judd, who was seemed to be seriously contemplating running against Mitch McConnell. So as often happens in campaigns, the people were getting together and they say, this is all the oppo we have on her, or the dirt, you might say. And a lot of it was publicly available, but it's kind of interesting to see how this side of politics works. And you had Mitch McConnell in the room as they went through various sort of material they could turn into political ammunition against Judd. And at the very beginning, Mitch McConnell's talking and he says, I don't know if this is what you're going to play, that this is the whack-a-mole time of the campaign.
I said, what if you play this game, whack-a-mole? The whack-a-mole period of the campaign?
What does that mean?
Well,
he's a whack-a-mole.
Well, if you've ever been to Rehoboth or Ocean City, it's a boardwalk game in which this animal, a mole, pops out of a head, and you have this big mallet, and you have to sort of hit it before it goes back down, and if you do, you get points. So basically, you have all these moles popping out of different holes, and the idea is to get them before they go anywhere. So it was Mitch McConnell saying, okay, we have all these potential candidates up there coming out. Let's get them before they even get started. And I don't know, maybe this is a Kentucky expression. He said, do them out. I don't quite know what that means, but I think it's pretty clear it means let's get them.
And then there was a second portion that you were able to obtain possession of, in which one of his aides is talking.
She's clearly, this sounds extreme, but she is emotionally unbalanced. It's been documented. Jesse can go in chapter and verse from her autobiography about, she suffered some suicidal tendencies. She was hospitalized for 42 days, and she had a mental breakdown in the 90s.
Yeah, they're talking about Ashley Judd. and about Ashley Judd's very public history of dealing with depression. They know about this because Ashley Judd wrote about it. The suicidal tendencies are when she was in sixth grade. That's what Ashley Judd was talking about. And in the 90s, she did go to a rehab center to deal with depression for, you know, what he said, 42 days. That was more or less accurate. But here they are kind of, and the other portions of the tape, they're kind of laughing about this. It's like, what a great opportunity we have here. You know, she's mentally unbalanced. And to me, this is, as we did with the 47% tape, this is the type of thing you can put out there. And it's really up to the individual listener to decide whether they're upset, outraged, or not nonplussed by this. Some people have said, oh, this is just what happens in politics. No big deal here. Other people have said this is really kind of outrageous that a leading member of the Senate would sit there while they talked about using someone's, you know, past publicly stated challenges with depression in a political campaign.
So then Senator McConnell himself said something to the effect that this was Watergate-style tactics.
Oh, yeah. He and his campaign, the first day they came out and they accused this of being Watergate. And the second day, I think it was Jesse Benton, his campaign manager, maybe another McConnell aide, who compared it to Gestapo tactics. So they went from Watergate to the Holocaust really fast. I'm in a position where I still have a confidentiality agreement with the source of the tape. So I can't describe or anything about the source or about what I know about the tape's origins. But it's been reported by others in Kentucky, and I can't say whether this is true or not, that, you know, that people have pointed at a political operative down there who was in the hallway who captured
a Democratic political operative
who captured the sounds coming from a room that he could hear while walking down a hallway. The biggest paper in Kentucky, the Louisville Courier Journal, had an interesting editorial just yesterday looking back on this. And, you know, they say, I'll just quote here, "The contents of the audio are as despicable as they are damaging, leaving Mr. McConnell unable to defend them." And they went on to say he's trying to divert the issue by talking about Watergate. And I think they're right. They said McConnell has masterfully diverted public attention from the offensive content of the tape, which is the real story here, by making these claims that it's another Watergate.
David Korn, he's Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones Magazine, also a contributor to MSNBC. His book is called Showdown, The Inside Story of How Obama Fought Back Against Boehner, Cantor, and the Tea Party. You can join us, 800-433-8850. David Korn, what a lot of people wonder is, had you heard the same kind of statement being made by now President Obama and a member of his campaign, would you have done the same thing?
Oh, yes, I would. And there was, remember the incident in the 2008 campaign, Mayhill Fowler, who was working for Huffington Post at the time, you know, who was a paid supporter of Barack Obama. I mean, paid up, meaning that she had made donations to the Obama campaign, and she was working for the Huffington Post, and her liberal leanings were no surprise. She was there when Obama talked about how people cling to guns and religion, and she put that story out there, even though she had reason to believe that it would be inconvenient for Barack Obama, as they were, you know, as he was competing with Hillary Clinton in the Pennsylvania primary. And I applauded that at the time. I thought that was really good. You know, this is what you do if you're a journalist. And a lot of people have tried to sort of, you know, deride me, a Mother Jones, for, you know, being part of opposition, political opposition research here. But I have to tell you that before the story came out, there was a person in Kentucky who was sympathetic to the Democrats, let me put it that way. I can't identify the person, but who got wind that I was going to do the story and contacted me and asked me not to. Why? Because this person wisely predicted that McConnell would come out and make himself the victim and it would help McConnell. So the only contact, or only conversation I had with anybody, this was just sort of inadvertent, I didn't even know why the person was calling at first, was someone from Kentucky saying, please don't do this because it will probably end up helping McConnell. And as we discussed in my office at the time, was of all the, you know, considerations that go into running a story like this, that is not appropriate. Whether it would help McConnell or hurt McConnell, you know, ricochet or whatever, that, you know, we decided was newsworthy or not. And so, to my critics out there who are saying that this is all politically motivated, in a lot of ways, they have it exactly wrong.
Why do you think this source came to you?
Well, the source, I believe, was no fan of McConnell and thought that, you know, that the public deserved to see the full McConnell. And which is why they came to me. And, you know, in journalism, people often come to you, whether you're at the Washington Post, the National Review, or Mother Jones, with information. And they usually have a motivation for doing it. It could be because they have a political axe to grind. It could be because they're outraged at a certain event or a corporation they work for. So you can look at that motivation, but the thing you have to assess is whether the information itself is accurate and worth posting and publishing.
And we're going to talk about that consideration, David Korn, of the Mother Jones magazine gave to that information.
Conversation with Diane Rehm continues in a moment here on WAMU 88.5. Hope you're enjoying your afternoon. I'm Elliot Francis. Coming up later.
Perspectives from different faiths brought together in the discussion on important issues on Interfaith Voices today at 4 on WAMU 88.5.
Tonight at 6 here on WAMU 88.5, it's Intelligence Squared. Back in 1938, President Roosevelt established our nation's first minimum hourly wage of 25 cents. Almost 75 years later, Americans are still arguing over whether we need one. Join us for a debate on the merits of the minimum wage. That's tonight at 6, right here on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from Freight Railworks. Privately owned freight railroads invest more than $20 billion into U.S. rail infrastructure annually, connecting a 140,000-mile network of industry daily. FreightRailworks.org.
This broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any phone calls.
And before we go into the kind of consideration that David Korn, who's Washington bureau chief for Mother Jones magazine, had to give the information he had received. Here's an posting on the website from PJ. What Senate rules did McConnell break by having a private conversation with his staff? The fact that they mocked a ridiculous political dilettante like Ashley Judd, who doesn't even live in Kentucky. Do you really think this stuff doesn't go on in every Senate office and the White House?
Well, it might. And if we have tapes about those other conversations, you know, and we can, we would disclose them. The story did not claim that Mitch McConnell violated any rules by doing this. Maybe the rules of good taste, as some people see it.
But he claimed you were wiretapping, or your source was.
Well, we can get into that in a second. But there are some people who have raised the issue of whether or not he used his Senate staff to do anything campaign-related in this opposition research. We put out a transcript that indicated that it might, but then there were a few words that people heard differently, and we issued a correction because a clarification is probably a better way of putting it, because it was unclear. But if he had used his Senate staff to engage in political activity, that would be a violation of rules. Other people raised that. It wasn't part of our original story. So we're not accused. We didn't issue any charges. Now, there's an interesting issue in journalism here about privacy. You know, we can talk about it two different ways. One is legal, and one is just sort of the notion of privacy. On the legal front, because you asked about what considerations went into this, of course we have lawyers. And we talk to our lawyers about when we do stories like this. And the lawyers in our case, in this case, and in the 47% case, said there was no legal issue with us publishing the story. There is a well-known Supreme Court case called Bartnicki v. Vopper, 2001. If you go to my Twitter feed after the show, David Korn, D.C., I'll put up a link to a story about this so we don't have to spend a lot of time. But in essence, it was about a talk show radio host and another media that got hold of a conversation between union people in which they said something threatening. And then one of those union people later sued and said, I was recorded illegally. You can't use this. And the court decided in 2001 that if a journalist obtains something legally, that is, if the journalist isn't involved in making something that might be illegal, that he or she have the perfect right to use that material. They can't be held legally accountable if someone broke the law, violated the law to make that tape, or I guess if someone stole a diary or something like that. And if you think about it, imagine if somebody, the National Review, or someone on the right, got a hold of some CIA cables that showed there was a cover-up in Benghazi and that they were leaked to them illegally. Well, would people be saying, wait a second, you should be prosecuted because you're using material that was leaked illegally? It's kind of an interesting legal issue, but there is no ambiguity about our legal right. In fact, I just have one quote. You can tell I came prepared for this. A University of Florida law professor named Clay Calvert was quoted in the Washington Post last week talking about this specifically. He said, if the news media lawfully obtained truthful information about a matter of public significance, then the government may not constitutionally punish publication of the information absent an interest of the highest order. So there was no legal issue with us using this. Privacy is another matter here. And it's, you know, you can talk about privacy in terms of a criminal violation of privacy, or just privacy in terms of good manners and good taste. And, in, you know, you could, whether the 47% tape or the McConnell tape, what we did, and I know what a lot of journalists do in these instances, is weigh, you know, someone's, you know, assumption or right to privacy versus what's newsworthy and in the public interest.
But what about the question of wiretapping? Why does or does that not apply?
Well, if somebody, I'm just going to speak theoretically here because I can't get into details to preserve my confidential arrangement with the source. If somebody broke into Mitch McConnell's office and planted 27 bugs and, you know, produced a transcript and gave me the transcript, or gave the New York Times the transcript, anybody else, or the NPR the transcript, and none of us had any knowledge or didn't induce the person to do it, didn't participate in it, even though that person could end up perhaps being, you know, going to jail for violating federal wiretapping statutes, nothing would happen to the journalists. The journalists have the right to use that information.
Did you make any attempt to talk directly with Senator McConnell?
Oh, yeah.
Before you published?
Oh, of course I did. A full day before we went out, and a full day in media time nowadays is like forever. You know, I contacted his campaign. I contacted his Senate office. I contacted his campaign manager.
To what end?
I said, I want to talk about this meeting you had February 2nd. I understand that McConnell said this about whack-a-mole, and I want to ask you what happened about this meeting and get your comment and get your response, whatever you want to tell me.
And?
Silence.
Nothing.
Nothing at all. But according to Chuck Todd of NBC News, he spoke to them when the story broke. They swept their office for bugs that afternoon or that evening before my story even came out. So they immediately suspected, oh, someone's been, you know, has bugged our office, which doesn't seem to be the case. So they acted on what I sent them, but they didn't respond at all. And since the story's come out, as the Louisville Courier-Journal and others have noted, Mitch McConnell and has yet to respond to any of the substance. He was asked about it repeated times, several times at a press conference the day this happened, and he would just go back to his talking points that it was Watergate, 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 and not even address the question of whether it was fair game or not to sort of giggle and laugh about Ashley Judd's history dealing with depression.
David, describe the process that you had to engage in to make sure that that tape was authentic.
Yeah, and I can only go so far without revealing things I can't reveal. But you know, the source approached us and described the tapes. You know, eventually sent a version of the tape, and we're able with some technical means to sort of get a sense whether it's edited and whether it's been fabricated. In this day of Photoshop and everything else, you never can get 100%. Somebody is really super duper good at this stuff. They could probably totally, forge a tape or a document. But if you look at the person who's bringing it to you and what their technical means might be, and you look at the quality of things, you can get a good sense of whether, to what degree there's a possibility you're the victim of a hoax. Obviously, in this case, we were not. And then you got to sort of authenticate it by saying, okay, could this have happened? And you check all the surrounding facts. Okay, there was a meeting. There was a grand opening on February 2nd. Mitch McConnell was in town. He wasn't off in China. The person who's bringing it to you seems to, be in a position to have access to this.
Did you bring voice experts in?
I didn't bring voice experts in because there is one line of Mitch McConnell in the tape. Mainly he's listening, and it's hard to hear over the air now, but when you put on headphones, it's pretty clearly him. And we were pretty clear that the tape hadn't been manipulated. And the thing is, one reason I called Mitch McConnell's office is because we didn't have identities for the other voices on the tape, particularly the person who leads the meeting. We had some ideas who they might be, and there is a reference to a Jesse attending the meeting, and his campaign manager's name is Jesse Benton, probably him, but we weren't sure. That's one reason I called the McConnell campaign and say, would you like to, would you care to identify these people?
And did Senator McConnell ever deny the substance?
No. There's been no denial at all. In fact, the response has been from the McConnell side that they've been, that they were the product of Watergate Gestapo bugging tactics, indicating, that at least the accuracy of the audio tape is not in question.
He called it Nixonian. Called it an invasion of privacy. The question becomes, was it legally or illegally obtained?
Yeah. And again, it's hard for me to get into that too much because
just tell you what USA Today is reporting.
Sure.
They said on April 11th that a Kentucky Democratic official said that two men tied to an anti-Mitch McConnell super PAC took credit for it.
Right. And the way that story also was reported was that Democratic official has now backtracked to say maybe it was only one of the two since he gave those initial interviews. And he said that they were in a hallway
when there was an open house.
Yeah, they went to an open house and they missed the open house, but they were in the hallway and recorded, hearing sounds coming from behind the door. Again, I can't say whether this is true or not, but I've seen legal commentary about it's kind of interesting. If you can hear sounds, is it true? And, there's a state laws, there are federal laws, and eventually there are reports that the FBI is looking into it at the request of Mitch McConnell. I assume a lot of that will be sorted out. But it's hard for me to sort of say anything about that. And, when you deal with sources, you get material in and it can go in a lot of different directions.
All right. Let's open the phones here. first to Lewisville, Texas. Good morning, Philip.
Hi, Diane. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks.
All right. I just had a question. I really just had two questions. First question is, do you think Obama, our commander-in-chief, would speak so crudely or just raw about certain issues involving tactics? And my second question is, whether he does or he doesn't, do you think this will turn into maybe a witch hunt for politicians that, I guess, play hardball and have to use some of these tactics that others that are outside the interest group might deem a little harsh to win an election or win their political campaigns? Thank you.
Interesting question. I mean, I can't really say whether Obama would privately or not. He was captured, I said earlier, talking about people clinging to guns and culture, and some people, you know, had different interpretations, guns and religion, and some people had different interpretations about how crude or damaging that was. It'd be great to see, you know, politicians open up the doors to their strategy sessions and to C-SPAN to see if they can defend any of this stuff. I think, you know, the 47% tape might be more apropos here, in that it's my hunch that after that came out, Mitt Romney certainly, and maybe a few other politicians, acted more cautious when speaking to people whenever there was more than two others in the room.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I think what you're saying is that every single politician, if he is not in his own bathroom, yeah, but perhaps by himself, is going to have to be careful of what she says.
You know, what was really striking to me after the 47% story came out, when the dust settled and I was thinking about it a little, was, why didn't this happen before? These people have been in rooms full of, whether it's a bartender, you know, a supporter's husband who may not, or wife who may not support the candidate, people who park cars, and everybody has a recording device on them practically now. And so to me, you know, everyone said, well, my goodness, this is like an amazing new development. And I was, you know, thinking, gosh, I can't believe it hasn't happened sooner. Now, I think we all in our society at large are dealing with, you know, attacks or decline in our privacy. And I have to say this, to me, as a journalist in doing a story like this, you know, there's a calculation. Is it enough of a story to go with? If I had a tape of, you know, a senator talking about a private family matter that didn't have anything to do with his running for office or his performance in office, I wouldn't use it. I would not use it. If it was a private matter that showed he was a hypocrite with what he was saying publicly, then I would use it. But I mean, I think there are lots of different calculations, and people might reach different calculations even with the same set of facts.
Remind us of the substance of the 47% statement.
Okay, well, that was a long fundraiser, about an hour long, with that Mitt Romney did in May of 2002, in which he was asked by one of the funders there, who had paid $50,000 a seat to go to this, to Mark Lader's house, a big hedge fund guy. He was a very private, couple dozen people at most. And Mitt Romney said, well, the question to Mitt Romney was, how are you going to get people to take responsibility for their own lives and vote for you? Meaning, you know, how can you win these votes of these people? And Mitt Romney said, there are 47% of Americans who will never vote for me. And these are people who don't pay taxes, who get government handouts, and who will, and you know, I should know the quote by heart, you'd think so, but who won't take personal responsibility for their own lives. So with that remark, he was actually getting the numbers wrong and was lumping together a lot of different groups of Americans. But he seemed to suggest that if you are Medicare, Social Security, if you use a federal financed drug rehab program, or if you're a veteran, getting veteran benefits, you are a freeloader, not take food stamps, Medicaid, not taking care of your own life.
And in that case,
and other thing he said, that he had no obligation to reach out to these people or do anything for them.
And in that case, it was a bartender who stood up and said he had actually filmed that.
Yeah, well, Scott Prody, who gave me the tape, didn't stand up at first. I mean, he was very courageous in giving it to a journalist, realizing that it would probably end up pointing back to him in some way or another at some point in time, if not publicly, at least maybe in terms of the people who he worked for and people in his own community. And as he has said, he came out about a month or so ago and outed himself, that he, spent a week or two looking in the mirror and saying, "My God, I have this tape. I don't know what to do with it. I mean, should I get it out? I mean, if I don't, I won't be able to live with myself. But if I do get it out, it may put me in jeopardy. More importantly, it may put my boss, the caterer, in jeopardy." And he really struggled with it for a long time before he and I connected.
David Korn, Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones Magazine. We'll be right back.
Coming up Monday on the Kojo Namdi Show, dramatic events after the Boston bombings put the city on lockdown. The challenge of balancing national security and individual rights in response to terrorist threats. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at kojoshow.org.
Young Playwrights Theater presents 12 plays written by students from D.C. area public schools. Professional actors will perform the plays, exploring subjects including a broken time machine and a sloth with an appetite for humans. WAMU 88.5 is proud to be a media sponsor for YPT's New Play Festival, tomorrow night and Tuesday night at Gala Hispanic Theater. More information is at WAMU.org under events.
Still cool this afternoon with highs only reaching the mid-50s. Tonight, look for partly cloudy skies with lows in the 40s. Monday, partly sunny. Warming up, though, highs in the upper 50s. It's 54 degrees in Northwest Washington at 2:38.
And welcome back. Journalist David Korn is with me. He's just received the prestigious Polk Award for political reporting. He's Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones Magazine and a contributor to MSNBC. Just before the break, David, we were talking about Mitt Romney's 47% statement. Do you believe it cost him the election?
You know, I'm in a really difficult or tough position to judge that. There are two ways of looking at it, whether it changed anybody's opinions about Mitt Romney. And on that score, I've talked to pollsters who worked on both sides of the campaign. And, they do believe that it reinforced and bolstered the attack and the critique that the Obama people were making against Mitt Romney. But a more sort of practical or down-to-earth or nuts and bolts way to look at this is that after the conventions are done, both political conventions, each campaign had, about nine weeks or so to implement their game plan. You know, when they're going to go to the middle, when they're going to run these type of ads or that type of ads, do foreign policy, make this type of attack, be positive, be negative. And, beyond any of my expectations, the 47% story, which we broke on a Monday afternoon, was a story remained in the headlines and in the news cycle for about a week and a half, which almost never happens anymore. The Thursday after that, so like 9-10 days later, I got a note from somebody at a major news broadcast who said the 47% tape was played again tonight on all three network news shows. This never happens. So I think for 9 days or a week and a half, Mitt Romney's whole game plan was thrown off kilter. Whatever he wanted to do with that time frame, which led up to the first debate, which he was able to do well in, he wasn't able to do well in. And it just sucked up all the oxygen and all the opportunity that he had. So I think in that way, and it'll be interesting to talk to Stuart Stevens or someone about that, being put on defense, not being able to stick to their game plan for a week and a half because of the story might have been the most serious impact of the tape.
All right, here's a tweet from Bad Example Man. David Korn, how do you feel about receiving the James O'Keefe seal of approval?
Well, it was a good laugh I got today. I guess we should say that, explain that on although I hate to promote this, but on the Daily Beast today, James O'Keefe has a story in which he kind of defends me. But the thing is, what I did was to use, in the 47% case and in the Mitch McConnell case, was to use, you know, tapes that had been given to me that I fully verified. And in each case, I put up unedited so people could see the whole thing. You know, James O'Keefe, thank you very much. But in several of your sting operations, you engage in selective editing of your tapes and you put someone like Shirley Sherrod, you know, in tremendous jeopardy. She lost her job because you took, in that instance, a tale she was telling about overcoming racism into a tale of, you know, an accusation that she was acting as a racist. So I see a complete difference. And I have to say, I've never been imaginative enough to try to lure a CNN reporter onto a yacht to show her sex toys, as he did with a CNN reporter, in some way to compromise her. I don't know, understand how that would even work. And he, I think, is on a probation now. If I have the facts wrong, James, I apologize for having tried to, you know, bug a Senator Mary Landrieu's office by going into her office to do it quite physically. So I see a world of difference, but I can understand why he's now trying to sort of associate what he does with more traditional journalism.
All right. Jerry in Michigan warns. He says, David, do not become overconfident. The people you are reporting on are not Boy Scouts. This is what they will try. They will provide you with all the evidence they have that they did something wrong. But with that evidence will be something they can easily disprove or at least make it impossible to verify. That's what happened to Dan Rather.
Oh, yeah.
The substance of his report on Bush being a deserter was a bombshell, but they blasted him on one irrelevant detail, and that became the story. Not only did it absolve Bush from the substance, it ruined Rather's career.
It's a tough game reporting on stories when you don't have full access to the people involved. So you have to make very prudent and cautious judgments about what to go with, what not to go with. I've had some people bring me certain tapes in the last couple of months after the 47% tape came out, which I've done nothing with because I couldn't confirm it. I wasn't sure about it. I couldn't get full access to it. So, you know, I thank the tweeter for his words of caution. And we do try to be very mindful of that, as I know almost all journalists are.
To Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning, Wes.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm listening and I'm really intrigued by all this, and you know, I'm a young 20-year-old, you know, fairly politically minded, and I really, this whole thing hits me as kind of, what is the big deal? You know, if we had tapes of politicians in their private quarters and their cabinets of all the politicians, I'm sure we would be shocked and amazed. You know, it's kind of this, it's just this, you know, this conversation that's heard, and I don't, you know, really know the context of the conversation or the tone or the inflection and what they're saying. And my point is like, it's just, I don't know what the big deal is about all of this. You know, I don't know that this is going to be an incredible determination of somebody's ability to serve the country as a politician. You know, I mean, so.
Well, if you want to hear the tone and inflection, you can, because we put up the audio tape so you can hear what they're saying. And as other people have reacted, they talk about her past struggles with depression and also her religious views in a very derisive, mocking tone. And it's up to every you know, voter and commentator to listen to this on their own and decide whether or not there's a reason to be outraged. You know, the Louisville Courier-Journal in their editorial yesterday said it was despicable. Now, they're not big fans of Mitch McConnell. Maybe that affected them. Maybe not. But, you know, I've gotten plenty of tweets, in the last few days from people who were aghast that a senator would participate in this. Other people are more cynical and say, of course, what do you expect?
And here is a tweet. It says, I'm sure David Corn would agree that Ms. Judd's potential health issues are a concern. I personally would not want an unstable senator.
Well, you know, I hate to tell you this. I think you already got a few. But that's neither here nor there. Again, you can listen to the tape and how, you know, saying that she had suicidal tendencies, we're going to make it, you know, we might use that as ammunition. That was when she was in sixth grade that she disclosed herself in a book writing about her past, her history. So now there may be someone out there who says, I don't want a senator who in sixth grade was suicidal. Okay, that's for you to decide. But as a journalist here, I am giving you that information. If you think it's not a big deal, if you think Mitch McConnell did nothing wrong, you're entitled to that belief.
Now, David, one of your college classmates has said of you, quote, he was meant to make trouble, and it really is a pleasure watching him do it. Is he right? Are you, in fact, a troublemaker?
Well, you know, were Woodward and Bernstein troublemakers? I'm not comparing myself to them. I mean, I'm doing what I like to do, which is journalism, which is, to me, the essence of journalism is showing people the truth of the world. And often that means getting behind a closed door and showing people what they otherwise would not get a chance to see. If you wanted to hear Mitt Romney talk candidly, you had to pay $50,000 a plate. Voters who had to make this most important decision of who to elect as president did not have all the information they needed. So in this instance, because of Scott, the bartender, we were able to give the public a little bit more information. Now, people, again, could decide how important that is. Same thing with the Mitch McConnell tape. This is, shining a light where, in corners that are usually kept in the dark. If that makes trouble for people, I think that happens because people want to do things in the dark.
All right, to Louisville, Kentucky. Hi there, Mike.
How are you doing, Diane?
Good, thanks. Thank you.
There's two statements, David, and one of them he just made that I really liked was the fact that there are some unstable senators and congressmen right now. But the statement you made in the very beginning of the conversation about Mitch McConnell making the statements and releasing the tape could make him more popular, which I absolutely, to a point, agree with that, because it makes him more approachable to the common people. Because if we were, I don't know if you played sports or you were in locker rooms in high school or in your office, there's always talk like that.
Right. Well, when I said that, what I had in mind, I take your point, it was a little different point, is that Mitch McConnell has terrible approval ratings in the state of Kentucky. He usually runs below the generic Republican, meaning that people like a Republican with no name better than they like Mitch McConnell. But he's a very good politician, and he's been able to win election to the Senate for five times. What is it, 30 years or so now? But conservatives in the last few years have really turned against him in the state. You know, he backed an establishment Republican candidate against Rand Paul, was nearly a civil war within the party. The Tea Party crowd in Kentucky, for some reason, I'm not even quite sure all the time, really, really despises him. So if he can make this past week a story of, I'm being attacked by the liberals, by the liberal media, liberal activists or whatever, that can help endear him to the conservatives, as Tea Party activists in Kentucky have been contemplating running a primary challenge against Mitch McConnell. So that's what I think is here, more than sort of trying to, find a way to connect with locker room talking types in Kentucky. This is a way of enhancing his appeal to conservatives to put off a Tea Party challenge.
You know, it's fascinating to me how little the public seems to hold grudges against people who do, you can call them make mistakes or say something they shouldn't make. Here you had Congressman Anthony Weiner on the cover of New York Times Magazine this week. He seems to be raring and ready to go. You had the governor, Hanford, who seems to be making a comeback.
Yeah.
These things don't seem to bother people.
Yeah, it's sort of a good time for politicians who have been caught with their, well, I won't even say it. This is what's great about.
What can you say?
I mean, listen, all you have to say is Bill Clinton. What Bill Clinton did was arguably worse than what Mark Sanford did and even what Anthony Weiner did. But, you know, the public decided at that point in time that it wasn't worthy of impeachment and that that was not the way to, you know, which shouldn't be used in a sort of a political warfare sort of way. And they liked what he was doing. But I need to make one small clarification. Can I?
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show.
Because during the last break, I couldn't help it. I checked my tweet feed and people were all Twitter about the fact that I said I was contacted by someone who was a Democratic sympathizer in Kentucky who asked me not to run the story beforehand. And they say, oh, the Democrats knew, and there's all no... And I can see a conspiracy theory aborting right before my eyes. But before it gets too far, I will say, I won't say who it was, because I can't do that, but it wasn't any Democratic official. It wasn't anybody that I know of, you know, in the Democratic leadership.
No,
it was someone I didn't know who just he may be a registered Democrat, I don't know, but he seemed to be sympathetic to the Democrats, and he seemed to not be representing anyone other than himself.
But David, as an investigative reporter, surely you found out exactly not only, obviously, who he was,
well, I knew he was.
His background.
Yeah, I knew who he was, but he wasn't acting as a Democratic Party representative.
You're saying he was there by accident?
No, I'm saying I'm talking about the person who called me, who heard that we had this tape. Now, how did he hear that from? Anybody, you can make a guess. I could make a guess, too. But it wasn't a Democratic Party, you know, leader who was acting on behalf of the Democrats.
All right, final call from Louisville, Kentucky. Yeah. Thane, you're on the air.
Yes, hello?
Yes, go right ahead, sir.
I'm a big fan of both you, Diane Rehm, and Mr. Korn. Mr. Korn, my question is, how if someone got a hold of compromising material, such as the McConnell audio or the 47% tape or something similar, how would they get in touch with you?
Oh, well, Mother Jones has a website that does have a sort of a tip line, a tip box. So you have to be able to find it. It's not so hard, but that's probably the easiest way to get something to me. So if you have something out there, and other, as I said earlier in the show, people have brought me other tapes, which we haven't used because they haven't, you know, passed, you know, certain vettings. But I'm always happy to look at any tips, any stories. Tapes or otherwise, and you can always tweet at me at David Korn DC if that helps.
All right, thanks for calling, Thane. That sounds intriguing, Dave.
Yeah, so we'll see.
You know, I wonder what all this takes from you and out of you.
Well, you get a lot of hate tweets from people who don't like this and who often are, you know, completely ignorant of the law and even of the circumstances. It doesn't take a lot for people to fire up, you know, Twitter and you know, I'm sure you get this too, and just, you know, just vent. And sometimes in the most awful, profane, you know, obscene manner. And as I said, you know, people who are upset politically, you know, maybe they should be happy this happened. Maybe this has helped Mitch McConnell. But it's... you know, if you do this sort of stuff, it seems in our hyperbolic, divisive political culture these days, you got to have a thick skin.
David Korn, he is Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones Magazine, a contributor to MSNBC, and has just received the Polk Award for Political Reporting. Thanks for coming on, David.
Thank you so much, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
Hi there, I'm Rebecca Scheer, host of WAMU 88.5's Metro Connection, and welcome to Door to Door, our weekly trip around the region. Today we visit Poolsville, Maryland, and the LeMond Riggs neighborhood of Northeast D.C.
Eddie Coleman, 62, live in Poolsville, Maryland. Poolsville is northwest Montgomery County. My family and I have lived here for about 31 years. Yeah, Poolsville is a small town. It resembles Mayberry from the Andy Griffith Show. It's a very caring community, close. You know most everybody, and it takes you a good while to go to the store because you bump into people you know and you end up talking. Every September, the main street in town is closed down for the day, and we have Poolsville Day, I believe it's this coming September will be the 21st one, and it's a great day. It's from one end of the town to almost the other end of the town, lined up with the kids, the church group. It's probably attended by 15 to 20,000 people. It's just a wonderful day, and it's grown every year.
My name is Caesar Dudley. We are in LeMond Riggs. I've lived here since 1959. We're bordered by New Hampshire Avenue, North Capitol Street, South Dakota, Eastern Avenue, and all of these streets are main streets that leads to Maryland, the major shopping centers that's in the outskirts. We came here when it was a very quiet, undisturbed neighborhood. We didn't have Metro. It was just a livable community. And then Metro changed the whole complexity of this neighborhood, and it's still changing. There are newcomers from there that established themselves in their apartments, condominiums, that we all have adjusted to each other. We don't want to lose this as a neighborhood, as a community. We have people here, you know, 30, 40, 50 years, 60 years. Some are old and on walkers and whatnot, but they're still active. We keep up with each other. That's what makes it such a great community. We share and care with one another. We get to know each other.